You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday the 6th of October 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say we have a special guest with us once again this week. We have Didymus Sumidid, the translator of The Origins of the Spanish Revolution, and he's here today to talk to us a little bit about the extreme violence that was seen by the left round about this time. We're going to be talking about the century between 1830 and 1930, and I'm very pleased to introduce him once again and have him back on the show. Didymus, hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. It's a very detailed book, and we really just sort of scratched the surface of it last time. And I know you particularly wanted to talk about some of this persecution of the church that went on, and also the fact that there were two different sides to the left. I'm very interested in these massacres of the church, because I don't really understand what turned the people against the church, particularly the working classes, because the church always looked out for the working classes and the poor. So something must have happened, and I'm hoping we can get into some of that today. So where and when did these massacres of the churchmen first begin in Spain?
So it seems like, you know, the Spanish Empire was in decline, slightly in decline, up until about the time of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. And they suffered very, very much. The entire country suffered a whole lot. The Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal both during those Napoleonic Wars. And a lot of people have pointed out that war dehumanizes people, because your family structures get destroyed when people get killed. You know, the father, the sons, the brothers, the breadwinners, they go off to war and they die, or they see horrible things and come back. Women get raped, children get orphaned, and so there was extensive fighting in the Iberian Peninsula during the Napoleonic Wars, and so that, I think, really set them off on the wrong course. And as to how many people died during that, it may have been in the hundreds of thousands, civilians and soldiers, and extensive fighting for, you know, a decade or more. But in the 1830s, we've got the first major, what they call anti-clerical, and cleric, of course, means priest, so this means anti-priest, but as a lot of Catholics have pointed out, you could just really say anti-Catholic, or you could even say anti-Christian. Anytime you see the word anti-clerical, you could just substitute that for anti-Catholic or anti-Christian. And so in 1834 and 35, they had essentially riots in several major cities in Spain, like Barcelona and Madrid. And what these rioters did is they targeted churches, including one very large one in Madrid, and they burned them down, basically after trapping the priests inside of the church, or the monks, I think it was. So they trapped these monks inside this big church and burned it down and killed them all. And that happened in multiple places. It happened in 34 and 35, and it was essentially centered in Catalonia, which prefigures the leftist violence of the 20th century that came out of Catalonia, and it also happened in Madrid. And we don't know exactly how many priests and monks were killed, but it was somewhere more than 100 and less than probably 300.
You know, that reminds me of what's going on today. I recently saw a map of all these churches that have been burned down in France. And I can recall reading earlier in the year that there was something like one church a day was being attacked over there. And The implication is that it was Muslims that were responsible for that, but this was anarchists, was it, that were doing this? I mean, why did they turn their ire against the church? We can understand that in Islam it's against any other religion, so they see the churches as idolatry, so they try to burn them down, they desecrate them. But why would the Spanish try to destroy their own churches when throughout history the church has provided lands for the working class to work upon, and they've provided food for the poor, they've provided education for people to better themselves? Why did they suddenly decide that they were going to go after the church? Because it seems to me that the church was the main benefactor of the poor and the working classes, and yet here you have a particular sadism as well, setting fire to the church while the people are in there. So what do you make of that?
I think that the earlier instances of this violence were probably perpetrated specifically by Masonic liberal elites, so they might basically round up some criminals and get some criminals to do this kind of thing. But the further on it goes, the more I think the more spontaneous and grassroots movements are doing this. So the question is, why did the working people, like you already asked, why did the working people turn against the church? But at least for this first event in the mid-1830s, it seems to me like it was probably Masonic elites and some soldiers and maybe some criminals who did this. But the overall reason for why this happened is that the Marxist, anarchist, Masonic propaganda, they all say the same thing, that the church, and particularly the Catholic Church, because we're talking about Spain, is they view it as kind of like a mob or a criminal organization that props up the existing power structure, which they think is composed of, you know, like a monarch whose position is unearned. He's just a parasite. And then they think that the big landowners who are squeezing the peasants and the capitalists and this whole social order is basically propped up by the church. If they think that religion is the opiate of the masses, then the only thing that's preventing the people from overthrowing the capitalist or monarchical order is the church. And so even though they don't battle directly against the church, they're not in the street fighting, you know, the forces of the church like they would have had to do in the Middle Ages, they still view the church as their main opponent because they have to undermine the church first in order to carry out their revolution. And so it seems like that viciousness that they often exhibit and the hatred that they have for Christianity and the extraordinary lengths that they'll go to destroy both church property and the people who make up the church administration and the priests, it all comes out of the fact that they view the church as the main obstacle to carrying out the revolution. If you have a religious Christian population, you're not going to get a far-left revolution. You're just not. So they have to attack the church first.
You know, it strikes me that they appeal to jealousy, don't they? These people, they've got more land than you, they've got more money than you, so you should be against them. And in the past, I think people used to look at people that were better off than them and say, well, thankfully, isn't it great that at least there are some people that are better off and don't have to live this way? Rather than being jealous of them and wanting to destroy it all, people used to be glad that there were people like that that did have a good life. I mean, this is why people supported the monarchy. At least somebody was given the best of everything. At least somebody had the best life that they could have. Rather than thinking, well, I'm jealous of him, why don't I have that? Why should he have something that I don't have? Let's just destroy it all. That's the mentality that lies behind this, I think. Was there any pushback against this? Did anybody go after these anarchists? And also you mentioned there that the soldiers were involved in this. So was the government sort of secretly involved in these attacks, or was it just the underworld, the thugs of the underworld? What do you make of that bit?
The way that it worked, it seemed to be that, or at least you can read about it in this book and other places as well, but the military was always a hotbed for Masonic activity. And this is because the majority of their people in the military were conscripts. They really didn't, you know, they weren't educated or anything like that. I'm really talking about the officer corps and especially the lower officers. These guys would form lodges just for the military officers, and then that's where this Masonic activity would take place. And so there's one instance in the book, I think it's in the 1860s, maybe the 40s, but they have a failed Masonic revolution where two of the regiments come out and try to overthrow the constitutional monarchy, but they fail. And so you've got part of the military trying to do a coup and then the other part of the military trying to overthrow it. And so if you read about this in the history books, it'll say, oh, well, it's liberals versus constitutionalists. But if you dig below the surface, it turns out that actually both sides are Masonic, but the side that was trying to do the coup were basically Jacobins. They're the most radical and bloodthirsty and the most Masonic. And so it seems like that's what happens is you're just a regular soldier, but your officer is a Freemason and a Jacobin. And then he's telling you, we've got to go kill these people. And you say, yeah, let's go. Let's do it. So that's basically the idea of how the military would be involved. Whatever ruling faction of the government is, they don't really want this stuff to happen because they have other ways of bringing about the kind of revolution that they want. But it seems like there's always a faction further to the left and more radical and more violent that says we have to have the revolution today. And if we have to swim through oceans of blood to do that, let's do it.
Did the church form a resistance to this? Were there any churchmen that decided that they were going to fight back? Did they form any organizations to resist against this? Or was this too early in the 1830s for that?
You know, I didn't find any real evidence anywhere from the 1830s all the way up through probably the 1920s of them organizing any strong resistance to this. I really didn't find anything. I'm sure they were doing things, but I just didn't really come across evidence of that. One thing that I did find, however, is in this book by a guy named Antonio Montero Moreno. We may talk about him later, but he wrote a 1,000-page book that details all of the mass killings of priests, monks, and nuns during 1936 to 39, the period of the Spanish Civil War. He has a short section near the beginning where he quotes a guy who was working in Catholic labor unions, so trade unions, working class associations of working men. And what this guy was doing is not Moreno, not the author of the book, but the one he was quoting. He was trying to build up Catholic trade unions to combat anarchist, syndicalist, and Marxist activity. The idea was that if the Catholics could go in there, build up strong labor unions, then they would be able to cut off all this far left activity. But the guy who was quoted in the book complained that he didn't get any support. He didn't get enough support from the Catholics and the conservatives. And I know that, more about nationalism than, most people I can think of. You know that conservatives really aren't good for anything. They might have good intentions. They might be good people. But when you really want them to stand up to the left and organize and do something, they're just not any good at it. And so they even had those problems in the 1880s, right? So what you could say is like these incipient radical right guys who wanted to form religious trade unions to combat Marxism, they didn't get the support. And so those Catholic labor unions sort of disintegrated and weakened over time. They really couldn't hold themselves together. And then eventually those working class people got sucked up into the Marxist organizations. And that created huge problems 10 or 15 years later.
Was there heavy weaponry used as well? I mean, I recall from researching what happened in Germany with the communists there, they were blowing up, or they had plans to blow up railways and post offices, and they had massive weapons stashes, and it was all building up until the National Socialists took power, and they raided all these places and locked up all these communists, and they were planning this huge armed revolution that they were going to have. Were there bombings and explosions and things like that were going on during this century, from 1830s up to the 1930s?
There were, and the high period for bombings was particularly from 1890 until about 1910, and that coincides with really strong anarchist activity. And if you've ever read anything about Russian anarchism and so-called nihilism, if you've read about the Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will, Land and Freedom, all these different revolutionary organizations, they were mostly active, I think, from the 1870s till about 1900. So the Spanish cases decade or two later than what happened in Russia, but they did almost exactly the same thing. They would make bombs, and they would take them to groupings of people in public, and they would find, you know, like a monarch or a nobleman or a big government official, and they would just throw dynamite into the crowd and blow people to bits. And this happened from 1890 up until about 1910, killing hundreds of people over, you know, various different events. And so that was the extent of it. I don't recall them ever using anything bigger than guns, you know, rifles and bombs. But the bombs were a huge deal. Seems like they were imitating the Russians. And all of these bombings were being organized precisely, completely by Freemasons. It's absolutely amazing. And in the notes I sent you, we talk about a guy named Francisco Ferrer, who was Tusquets calls him Masonry's favored son, because from 1890 up until he was executed by the Spanish government in 1909, he was really the ringleader of terrorism and revolution in Spain. And so maybe we'll talk a little bit about him at some point. But, you know, under his direction, these people were blowing up opera houses. They blew up a church procession in 1897. They tried to blow up Alfonso XIII, the king of Spain. They tried to blow him up at his wedding, you know, at his wedding. How pathetic is that? And various other events. But to answer your question, they mostly stuck to bombs and guns.
You know, I'm wondering if there's a parallel here that we can draw with Black Lives Matter. And back then, they were identifying the nobles as the enemy and the aristocracy as the enemy, and they're going after them in the way that you say. But there must have been protests and unrest before that happened. And I'm wondering today, rather than it being the aristocracy and the nobles, they're identifying the racists as the problem. So they're pulling down the statues, you know, looting, they're rioting. And I'm wondering if in the next couple of years we might see targeted attacks in the same way that we are seeing here with bombings and explosions and things like that going off. Was there looting and rioting that was going on at this time as well, do you know?
Yes. So there was one particular event that's called the Tragic Week, and that occurred, I think, in 1909. Spain had taken over Morocco as a colonial territory from France, and then also carried out its own colonial expeditions in Morocco. But they had a rebellion in 1909, I think in June or July. And they didn't have much of a professional army, so they had to do conscription. So they had to conscript 10 or 15,000 soldiers, and nobody wanted to go. You know, they didn't want to go to Morocco and fight for these colonial holdings. And honestly, I can't really blame them, because I don't think white people should be in Muslim countries anyway. We ought to just leave them alone. But anyhow, they wanted to build up their empire, and so they did this expedition in their colonial territory, and it led to riots. And then the Marxists got involved in the riots. The workers made a strike, and so it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And Francisco Ferrer got in there and tried to actually turn this stuff into a revolution itself. You know, he wanted to actually push this to overthrow the government. But even the anarchists and the strikers and the soldiers didn't actually want to do that, so it failed. But during those events in 1909, these people burned down, I think, 50 churches, and, you know, several hundred people were killed and thousands were injured. So this was like the big revolutionary event. And it's kind of a repeat of what we had talked about that happened, 70 or 80 years earlier in the 1830s. So you have it in the mid 1830s, and then you have the really big event in 1909, which both of those prefigure what happened later. But that was the big attack on the church and church property. So they would burn down the stuff. They would haul all the sacred images out of the church into the street and tie them to a horse or a cart. And so they would drag the statues of the Virgin, or they would drag the crucifix, you know, or the image of Christ through the street and kick it and throw stones at it, and loot the valuables that were in the church itself. That's basically what they were doing.
So there was general unrest anyway, and then there were people, Marxists, that were moving in there and trying to direct it and trying to take it over, the same as Antifa moved in straight away with Black Lives Matter, and there were even camps that were springing up around Portland that were just full of looters and rioters ready to go out, sort of rent a mob, ready to just go out to wherever they wanted to target the rioting and the looting. So we had the same thing going on back then. You were pointing out that this Francisco Ferro was quite central to that. So what happened to him?
He's got a very interesting life history, and there's even been a recent English biography written on him by anarchists and people who are basically the anti-fascists. You can look him up. Last name is Bray, B-R-A-Y. And if you look up him and Francisco Ferrer, you'll find this biography. And so these people believe exactly the opposite of what we believe. But at the same time, they admit this guy is, you know, he's a revolutionary. He's a Freemason. He's an internationalist. And what he's got two faces. He has a public face and a private face. His public face is that, look, guys, Spain needs to move into the modern era. We need to have quote unquote rational education. And I've got new methods for teaching children that are going to really do great. It's going to bring us into the new era. And then it turns out that his educational program is taking the exact same way that children are already being taught, taking out all of the religious content and the traditionalist content and substituting it with basically, you know, free love, anarchism, Marxism, and these kind of things. So it's kind of fraudulent, honestly, because there's really no advancement in methodology there. But then his private face is that he's moving among all of the biggest Freemasons and anarchists and other social revolutionaries in Europe. You know, he's going back to England, France, and Spain, and he's saying that we need to dynamite people, we need to blow them up, we need to kill the king, we need to kill the king because specifically it could bring about a revolutionary moment. Jonathan Bowden, in one of his lectures, pointed out that these anarchists don't think that, you know, killing one important person is that big of a deal, but what it does is it opens up the political space for revolutionary activity because it creates unrest and it destabilizes the situation. So that's really why they blow people up who are important. But Ferrer, he organized or was heavily involved in the attempts to blow up the king in 1905 and 1906. He got caught. He got put on trial in 1907 and somehow got acquitted. But after the events of the Tragic Week in 1909, the government had had enough, and they arrested him, tried him, and executed him very, very quickly. And this really offended, of course, the internationalists, the globalists, the Freemasons, the worldwide liberals. And I think that's when they decided to really make Spain a personal project to be, you know, basically just like Russia and to have a Bolshevik revolution there. So the guy was highly connected, and he became a martyr. And they had these Ferrer Society set up in Belgium and France and other places where they were idolizing him. But the guy was really, you know, he wasn't that much to speak of unless you're a revolutionary. And then you could say this guy was doing what we want. But standing back from it, not too much special about him.
As I was looking up on images today, looking for an image to go with this podcast, all these Francisco Ferrer images were coming up, and they were all portraying him as some kind of martyr. And what it reminds me there, when you were saying about how all he did was basically have the same way of teaching children, but just took out all the religious stuff, it reminds me of what they're doing today with the homosexual lobby. It's still the same way of teaching children, but they've substituted all the heterosexual acts for homosexual acts and miscegenation, and they're trying to portray that idea as normal and perfect and good rather than the normal way of producing children, and they've taken that completely out of it. So it's the same thing that's going on today as was going on back then. It's just progressed from taking religion out of it to now just taking out heterosexuality completely from it and teaching this stuff to children of the age of 5, 6, 7 years old. So this takes us up to around about 1936, where things suddenly, there's a big explosion in violence, and there are thousands of priests, monks, nuns that are all slaughtered. So what happened there at that point?
So let's see. So in In 1917, they had a similar blow up that didn't really lead anywhere. In 1931, as we talked about last time, there's like a two-stage progression, it seems to me, to get to a communist revolution. You can't go straight from monarchism and conservatism to communism. You have to have first, the liberals have to come in. They have to clear away the old stuff and get us into a progressive frame of mind. And they also have to create, you know, like capitalism to get an urban underclass. You have to have capitalism before you can have communism, it seems like. Except in China with Mao, where it's a completely different story. But anyhow, you get the liberals in power from 31. And then in 36, everything blows up because, like we talked about last time, you get an election that's 50-50, split straight down the middle. No one's ready to accept this kind of result, neither the left nor the right. And so then the Civil War starts. And basically at the same time that the Civil War starts, the anarchist and communist militias start going around and executing monks, priests, and nuns. And so of the 6,000 monks, priests, and nuns who were executed, I think most of them would have been killed in 1936. I wish I could tell you exactly the proportion that was killed early on, but everybody agrees it was almost all at the start. And so basically you can imagine, you can look at Antonio Moreno's book, The History of Religious Persecution in Spain, 36 to 39. You can find that on archive.org. And it's story after story after story, along with the names and dates and locations of all 6,000 religious who were killed. But you can imagine in one case there were eight nuns who were working in an area where they had a religious school. And then there was a priest there maybe to come and hear their confessions, priest who would travel through the area. The anarchists show up. They knock on the door. They take the nuns basically to a, what do you call it, a people's court, you know, this classic communist structure. They put the nuns on trial, and then they take them out back and shoot them. And then they, another thing that they commonly did is they would go into the crypts or the mausoleums, and they would haul out the corpses of the dead priests or dead nuns in the convent because, you know, they would have their bodies preserved in their tomb or whatever. And they would throw the bones or the corpses out on the front step and stomp on them, or they would dance with them, and they would do all these, I don't know what you would call it blasphemy and obscenity, I guess is what you would have to call it. But they would do all these sorts of things, and it just happened all over Spain for month after month until the nationalists eventually recaptured these areas that had been under red control for, you know, months or years by that point.
Yeah, it really reminds me of where we're heading today when I see these statues being pulled down, and you know, it's just an insane animalistic mob, and they're screeching, and they're in a state of hysteria, and they're lynching the statue, they're throwing paint over it, they're kicking it, they're trying to destroy it with chainsaws, and you got the same thing going on there, only it's relics and old Christian icons that are being pulled out and demolished. I think we're just really just one step away from this at the moment. So what you're saying is that there are two forms of the left. We've got this liberal left that ends up promoting capitalism, and then we've got the anarchist left that ends up fighting against it. I think maybe that ties in with the two forms of masonry as well, the Rosicrucian masonry, the British masonry that does support the monarchy, and then you've got the French continental Freemasonry that seeks to take it all down and promote the anarchist ideas and is aimed at the working classes. So would that be correct? Is that the sort of two styles of leftism that you were trying to highlight here?
That's the way that I see it. It seems to me like there's this natural progression where you go from the old Europe, the Europe, the Christian Europe of the Middle Ages, and you don't even have to be a Christian to appreciate this. You just have to understand that we had certain social structures that were in place, that worked for us, that we were used to, that are probably an expression of our racial soul, whether it's pagan or Christian in form. You know, it's still us. It's the European way. And then capitalism and liberalism come in and they sweep all that stuff away and they create the urban underclass that the Marxists, that the exploitation creates the urban underclass. And then the Marxists come in and they use those people as cannon fodder to take power. And the thing that binds both of these groups together, the Masonic liberal order, and then the anarchist communist order is, of course, Jewish money power, because Freemasons and liberals can't get by without money, and neither can communists. And who's got the money? So, the Jews seem to thrive both in liberalism and capitalism, and also in communism. You know, how is this possible, right? These systems are opposed to each other. They don't even really like each other that much, and they definitely want to destroy all the indigenous European stuff. But somehow it seems like you always find Jews associated with both sides of this in high positions. So that's the transition that Russia went through in the 19-teens, and it's the same thing that happened in Spain. That process basically from 1830 and up until 1930.
And the nationalists provide the only alternative, the only genuine alternative, because you got two sides here that are being controlled by the same money power. I mean, this is why nationalists are known for exposing the Jewish money power, because we're the only ones that do that. And the money power is predominantly Jewish. We've just seen recently that Laura Taylor had a bank account taken away from her. And what was the reason for that? Well, the reason was because this Jewish advocacy group wrote to her bank and managed to get the bank to remove her bank account. I mean, you don't get a better example of that happening than that. And the same thing has been going on throughout history. And while our people are engaged in fighting against each other between the communists and the liberals, it's the money power that just gets richer and richer and gets more and more power. And the people that are at the top become more and more corrupt. And the only genuine people that are actually speaking about this and that are trying to find ways to resist it and not fall for these temptations are the nationalists. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Didymus. I really enjoyed that. I'm sure the listeners will as well. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.